We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app, the biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
All right, welcome back. A Monday afternoon. I have lived in, well, I should say back in St. Louis County now for almost 3 years. And you know what I miss about Jeffco, Dave Klein, who lives pretty close to me in St. Louis County, the Fenton area? I miss the fireworks stands. I went over to where my old home is, over kind of by Romaine Creek, you know, where the Pink Elephant is, over there on 141. My wife's aunt bought a home and was moving in over the weekend, and I noticed the fireworks stands, and then I could hear the fireworks, Dave. You know, we kind of are on the border of St. Louis County and Jeffco, right? So you can hear the difference at times, can't you?
Oh, absolutely. I've actually been hearing the fireworks, I've noticed, for probably about a good week now, and it seems like it's pretty early for that. You know, usually I think they would start around now, but at least I think since June 20th I've been hearing them, which seems early.
Well, I think it's early because people are bored, and you've seen some of the stories about the fireworks in the big cities keeping people up all night as well. I've been hearing some every night in the distance. My neighborhood had quite the display last year, so we'll have to see what people do. I tend to not waste my money on fireworks. I let other people do it. I do like them. I like watching them, but I also like my fingers. Hey, I got one more question for you here because I'm going to go off on this this book here, and maybe it's just because I don't pay close enough attention to book lists or things along those lines. Have you heard about this book, White Fragility?
I have. Yes. Okay. I'm very familiar with
so
it.
So you've heard about it.
Yes.
So this is a number one bestseller. And when you say you're very familiar with it, did you see it like on The Tonight Show or anything like that?
I know people that have read it. And I have read passages from it myself.
All right, here we go, Dave. That's all I need to know. And this is from Matt Taibbi. This is very interesting to me. Matt Taibbi's a guy that, I mean, I've never met Matt, I've never interviewed him, but we could not be on the more opposite end of the political spectrum. But I read his work, and I've continued to read it. He writes for Rolling Stone. He wrote a piece a few weeks ago I highlighted about the media and how the media has lost their mind, and they're doing great disservice to themselves throughout the aftermath of George Floyd. So then he wrote a column, and this is out today, on white fragility. And here's what he said. Now, this guy is no conservative, okay? I just want people to know that. A core principle of the academic movement that shot through elite schools in America since the early 90s was the view that individual rights, humanism, and the democratic process are all just stalking horses for white supremacy. The concept, as articulated in books like former corporate consultant Robin DiAngelo's White Fragility, Amazon number one bestseller, reduces everything, even the smallest and most innocent human interactions, to racial power contests. You know, we talked about this last week when Robin Quivers, Howard Stern's co-host, wrote a piece about maybe part of the problem here is our obsession with race, right? So Taibbi says it's been mind-boggling to watch white fragility celebrated in recent weeks. When it surged past a Hunger Games book on bestseller list, USA Today cheered. American readers are more interested in combating racism than in literary escapism. When DiAngelo appeared on The Tonight Show, Jimmy Fallon gushed, "I know, everyone wants to talk to you right now." White Fragility has been pitched as an uncontroversial roadmap for fighting racism at a time when, after the murder of George Floyd, Americans are suddenly and appropriately interested in doing just that. Except this isn't a straightforward book about examining his own prejudices. Have the people hyping this impressively crazy book actually read it? So Taibbi says DiAngelo isn't the first person to make a buck-pushing, tricked-up, pseudo-intellectual horse crap, use a different word, as corporate wisdom. But she might be the first to do it selling Hitlerian race theory. White Fragility has a simple message There is no such thing as a universal human experience. We are defined not by our individual personalities or moral choices, but only by our racial category. If your category is white, bad news. You have no identity apart from your participation in white supremacy. And by the way, if you think that we're making this up, think about the last 3 weeks and what we've heard. Anti-blackness is foundational to our very identities. Whiteness has always been predicated on blackness, which neutrally or naturally, I'm sorry, means a positive white identity is an impossible goal. These are quotes, by the way. D'Angelo instructs us that there is nothing to be done here except strive to be less white. Again, that's a quote that Jimmy Fallon and the rest of the media are holding up as examples of, you know, extreme positive movements in healing our racial issues, right? To deny this theory, to have effrontery to sneak away from the tedium of D'Angelo's lecturing, what she describes as leaving the stress-inducing situation, is to affirm her conception of white supremacy, this intellectual equivalent of the ordeal by water. If you float, you're a witch, is orthodoxy across much of academia. You know, he nails it here. This is one of the problems moving forward. Maybe this is a good thing that people won't be going to, you know, institutions of higher learning as much as they were, because they're just brainwashing a lot of these kids. I have two that are 20 and 23 right now that are an example of this. So Taibbi says, the lexicon favored by intersectional theorists of this type is built around the same principles as Orwell's Newspeak. It banishes ambiguity, nuance, and feeling, and structures itself around sterile word pairs like racist and anti-racist, platform and deplatform, center and silence, that reduce all thinking to a series of binary choices. Ironically, Donald Trump does something similar, only with words like amazing and sad that are simultaneously more childish and livelier. Keep in mind, Matt Taibbi, not a, you know, he's a lefty. So, I mean, I just think that it's really interesting, because one of the things that she does here is she talks about the I Have a Dream speech. And one of the lines of the speech by Dr. King in particular, that one day he might be judged by the content of his character and not by the color of his skin, was seized upon by the white public because the words were seen to provide a simple and immediate solution to racial tensions. Pretend that we don't see race and racism will end, the book says. Colorblindness was now promoted as the remedy for racism, with white people insisting that they didn't see race, or if they did, that it had no meaning to them. That this speech was held up as the framework for American race relations for more than half a century, Taibbi says, precisely because people of all races understood King to be referring to a difficult and beautiful long-term goal worth pursuing, is discounted. White fragility is based upon the idea that human beings are incapable of judging each other by the content of their character. And if people of different races think that they're getting along or even loving one another, then probably they need immediate anti-racism training. This is an important passage because rejection of King's dream of racial harmony, not even as a description of the obviously flawed present, but as the aspirational goal of a better future, has become the central tenet of this brand of anti-racist doctrine mainstream press outlets are rushing to embrace. And Matt Taibbi's absolutely right. So he talked about Jackie Robinson, classic example of how whiteness obscures racism by rendering whites, white privilege, and racist institutions invisible. Robinson is often celebrated as the first African-American to break the color line. By the way, they're celebrating the Negro Leagues today. You know that, right? While Robinson was certainly an amazing baseball player, this storyline depicts him as a racially special, a black man who broke the color line himself. The subtext, the book says, is that Robinson finally had what it took to play with whites, as if no black athlete before him was strong enough to compete at that level. Imagine if instead the story went something like this: Jackie Robinson, the first black man whites allowed to play Major League Baseball. So some of this is just ridiculous, okay? It really is. And Matt Taibbi highlights this. There's not a single player, or I'm sorry, a single baseball fan anywhere, literally not one, except for perhaps Robin DiAngelo, who believes Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier because he finally had what it took to play with whites. I mean, it's ridiculous. He was an exceptional player and human being. And it took that to confront Major League Baseball, which at the time was a racist institution. It was a complex story, a long developing political tale about overcoming violent systemic oppression. So this woman just recast Jackie Robinson as the first black man whites allowed to play Major League Baseball. And it's the number one book in the country. And USA Today and Jimmy Fallon and everybody else is heaping praise. Now, this, by the way, this column is outstanding. And he goes off on Robin DiAngelo in such appropriate ways. I wish I could read the whole thing to you. I'll put it up on the Mark Reardon Show Facebook page, and we'll put it on Twitter, too. But the example, it's just example after example of what this book is preaching. And I'm just wondering, I think Matt Taibbi's kind of wondering if people are really reading it or they're just looking at the headlines saying, yeah, they're doing virtue signaling. That's my guess. So he says, look, the notion that color blindness is itself racist, one of the main themes of this book, could have amazing consequences. In researching I Can't Breathe, I met civil rights, I met civil rights activists who recounted decades of struggle to remove race from the law. I heard stories of lawyers who were physically threatened for years in places like rural Arkansas for just trying to end explicit hirings and housing discrimination and other remnants of Jim Crow. Last week, an Oregon county casually exempted people of color who have heightened concerns about racial profiling from a COVID-19 related mask order. Who thinks creating different laws for different racial categories is going to end well? When has it ever? At a time of catastrophe and national despair, when conservative nationalism is on the rise, again, a reminder here, he does not like conservatives, all right? That's why I think this is an interesting piece. And violent confrontation on the streets is becoming commonplace. It's extremely suspicious that the book's politicians, the press, university administrators, and corporate consultants alike are asking us to read, are urging us to put race even more at the center of our identities and fetishize the unbridgeable nature of our differences. Meantime, classic pieces of literature, The Adventures of Huck Finn, To Kill a Mockingbird, beautiful books, anti-racist books, but they've been, because they have the N-word, they've been banned. You know, Matt Taibbi says it's almost like someone thinks there's a benefit to keeping people divided. You think? 318 at KMOX.
Miss any part of the Mark Reardon Show? Download the podcast anytime.
Initiating download. Stand by.
At KMOX.com/Reardon.
All right, so in 2014, evil Republicans in the state of Louisiana passed a restrictive abortion law. Except it wasn't evil Republicans. It was a Democrat who sponsored it, and it was a Democrat governor who signed it into law. But the facts don't matter, ladies and gentlemen, especially with Joe Biden saying Republicans are trying to do this to you. So they require doctors to perform abortions to have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals. And that court went to the Supreme Court. It was ruled upon today, and they struck down that law, which could have left Louisiana with a single abortion clinic. President's disappointed in that. It was Chief Justice John Roberts who added the crucial fifth vote. And we're going to talk about this a little bit this afternoon and the precedent that he cited, because it's obviously an important case and a lot of people were paying attention to this. Charmaine Yost is with the Heritage Foundation, joins me this afternoon. How are you, Charmaine? Thanks for coming on here.
Oh, thanks for having me. Good to be with you.
So Justice Roberts basically cited precedent here, didn't he? Stare decisis?
Well, that's what's funny about it. 4 years ago in the Hellerstadt case, which was admittedly very, very similar to this one, and the Supreme Court overruled it, and Justice Roberts dissented in that case and said he disagreed with it. And then here we are 4 years later, a very similar case with that is a much stronger case, and Justice Roberts contradicted himself and said, well, you guys, in your case 4 years ago, you decided one way, and so we're going to have to stick with that, even though at the time I said that I thought it was wrongly decided. So it's just it's elevating the principle of precedent over the Constitution, and that's just not what being the sacred duty of being a judge is all about.
Well, what is the, you know, I guess maybe what's going on here is what the question would be with Justice Roberts, because it's a bit of a trend that's developing, isn't it?
Well, what do you mean by that?
Well, I guess in these split decisions where you have expectations with a conservative justice, obviously with an appointee from President Bush, in maybe cases that when people went to the polls to elect Donald Trump in 2016, one of the reasons that they put as, and I think that the polling even indicated this, was because of the Supreme Court choices. They got two out of this president. Obviously, Justice Right. Roberts was not from Donald Trump. But with the results of the Supreme Court cases, I think that comes as a surprise to a lot of people who supported Trump and his choices.
Right, exactly. These 5-4 decisions were not supposed to continue breaking against us. And, you know, we had this last week with Gorsuch as well, as you said, where, you know, again, we're end up being surprised. And I think what happens is you get these conservative justices who start getting really honing in on some technicalities, whereas you don't see that happening coming from the other side. But even in this case, it really should have broken differently, and it's very, very disappointing that Roberts would do this, because he's literally going against what he himself said just four short years ago. And, you know, Justice Thomas wrote a dissent. In fact, all four of the other conservative justices wrote dissents, and Clarence Thomas really nailed home exactly the principle that, you know, when a prior ruling of the court clearly conflicts with the Constitution, a justice has a duty to the Constitution and not to uphold a mistaken ruling from the past.
Yeah, he basically makes it clear, and he dismantles this position, because basically Justice Roberts thinks, if we get this correctly, the whole women's health case that you refer to, he still thinks that that's misguided, right? So he's right. Voting to reinforce both the Casey case and that, rather than take the opportunity to review either or both decisions. And then Justice Thomas sort of points out that the five justices ignored the real question, which was that of standing to challenge the law in the first place. So, you know, I don't know what, in the end here, this means that there's not going to be, as expected, a more direct challenge to Roe, right?
Well, and let me just put a fine point on what you just said, which is, you know, they're overlooking the real point, which is women's health. And the fact that, as you correctly pointed out, some Democrats down in Louisiana looked at what was going on in the abortion industry. June Medical Services, one of the parties involved here, has a tremendously troubling history of violations, have been cited 13 times since 2004. For health violations and doing some really, really egregious things. And frankly, requiring an abortionist to have admitting privileges at a local hospital is just very plain vanilla kind of stuff.
Yeah, it doesn't seem that outrageous, right?
No, and it's a regulation that was clearly designed to protect women. If they need to be admitted to the hospital, the abortionist who did the procedure needs to be able to get them into the hospital. So it's just really kind of ludicrous. And, you know, frankly, the pro-life movement is just going to really have to dig deep and say, we're going to push forward and find the next case.
I mean, there usually are cases sort of waiting in the wings, aren't there?
Sure. I mean, there's plenty of others out there. I used to head up Americans United for Life, which was heavily involved in these kinds of abortion regulations across the country. And there's a lot of them across the country. And so the Supreme Court may have the opportunity to review other laws in the future, including the pain capable abortion ban, one on an abortion ban based on Down syndrome. You know, there's some other really kind of common sense abortion regulations out there that will eventually come up in front of the court.
Appreciate it. Coming on, Charmaine Yost with the Heritage Foundation. Interesting case today in this 5-4 decision. Have a great week.
Thanks, you too.
3:29 at the Voice of St. Louis. We'll take a break here. Carol has all of the news. And then, you know, I mentioned, we talked about the St. Louis statue at Art Hill and the controversy. I had someone reach out who is a descendant of the man who created that statue, Captain William Romaine Hodges. And she's going to join me on the other side of the news to maybe offer another perspective here on this statue. I wonder if Brent Lee and the protesters are going to listen. It's 3:30 at KMOX.
Get ready for another Cardinals Classic game, sponsored by Lux Galore International. Tonight,
from 2013, the National League Championship Series Game 1 between the Cards and Dodgers. Hear it here, Ameren Pregame Show 615 on your voice of the St. Louis Cardinals, KMOX.
3:38, we have an audio cut of the day right into Total Information PM on KMOX at 4 o'clock. On an email this morning from somebody who is a descendant of the man who created the statue that many of the protesters are trying to tear down, the St. Louis statue. And with me this afternoon, Beth Anderson Einig, who is the great-granddaughter, the great-great-granddaughter, I got to get that straight. There's two G's, right? Great-great-granddaughter of Captain William Romaine Hodges. How are you, Beth? Mm-hmm. Did I get that right? It's great-great, right?
Yes, it is. Great-great.
So you sent an email out, and this was erected way back in 1906, and your reaction is a perspective I think that is needed here, the descendants of the person who put the statue up and some of the background and the history here. And you have newspaper clippings and pictures and all kinds of things that you've sort of gathered. So I wanted to have you on here this afternoon to sort of respond. Overall, when you started hearing about this, what was your reaction?
Well, I was appalled, obviously, because, you know, this statue, the family's been proud of it forever, since 1906. My great-great-grandfather was extremely proud to be able to get the casting done and erect it and design the base. And he talks about it in his memoirs. I have transcribed his memoirs talking about his role as a captain in Sherman's army in the Civil War and how he fought slavery. And how he fought bigotry and injustice in St. Louis as city auditor, and is just a man of importance in the town of St. Louis around the 1900s, early 1900s. So for us, it's been it's pride. We have a pride in that statue because he did this, and he was the one in charge of doing this. And I actually had to bring this information to the Missouri Historical Society, to the Art Museum, to let them know he was the person who did this. He is in the clippings from that time period, and they were the actual clippings that I was able to photocopy about 30 years ago, actually. I got them from my grandfather, who also was pretty well known in St. Louis.
So, but from your perspective, and one of the things you said in the email, not only emphasizing that Captain Hodges was very anti-slavery and talks about these things in the memoirs, but your interpretation, the interpretation of the statue itself, is it represents all those who fought against slavery and not the king who lived over 800 years ago?
Right. Now, exactly. It represents the city of St. Louis. When you think about it, it's St. Louis was founded as a French trading post, and that's why it's named St. Louis after a saint. King Louis the Ninth was declared a saint by the Catholic Church for a lot of reasons. He was a very pious man. He was very devoted to the Catholic Church. And by the way, I'm not actually Catholic. I am Episcopalian, but that being said, he was a very devoted man, devoted to Jesus. He supported the poor. He actually fed the poor at his table and washed their feet on Saturdays. You know, he opened up hospitals, and we're talking 800 years ago. He opened up hospitals for the poor, for women. He took care of people. Yes, did he go on a crusade? Yes, he tried to take, you know, the Holy Land back for the Christians. That's what he did. Other than that, he was an extremely good man, and that's why he was made a saint. And the city of St. Louis was founded on his beliefs, on his values, I think. My grandfather would not have probably wanted to erect that statue if he thought that King Louis the Ninth was a bad man, truthfully, because he was totally anti-slavery.
So at this point, I'm obviously your email, I sense a level of frustration. You're trying to do something here. It'd be nice to have conversations that are civil with some of the protesters that get all this attention to educate them a little bit. But where are you in this process? Have you tried, you know, it'd be nice to get this information, if she's not aware, to the mayor and to others who may be able to better represent what that statue's about?
Well, that's what I started doing, basically, when I reached out on Facebook. I reached out in on the pages that support the statue, let people know who I was, that I am a descendant of the man that did erect the statue, and that we are all very upset in my family that there is even a remote possibility of having the statue taken down. So that's how I started, is just contacting people to see what could I do. Is there anything I can do to keep this from happening? Because, number one, it's in front of the art museum. It's a statue. And it's a piece of art that is in front of the art museum. And he was not a slaveholder as king. He valued the poor. So taking his statue down, to me, makes no sense whatsoever. The city of St. Louis has been the city of St. Louis forever. And I just don't see the point in all of this. And it's just really upsetting to me to think that what my great-great-grandfather built, and a man who was as honorable as he was, that it could be taken down so randomly like this. It just blows my mind.
Well, I would hope that it's not going to be taken down randomly, and I hope some of this settles down, but I'm glad that you reached out to me, and I hope some other people give you a little attention here about your great-great-grandfather, Captain William Romaine Hodges, and, you know, find out a little bit more of the history, because I didn't know some of what you just told me, and I'm assuming a lot of people didn't. So it's an easy target, and unfortunately, look, some of the troublemakers know how to manipulate the media, and I think that there is an overwhelming level of support on your side of this, but you just don't hear that. That's part of the problem. So I guess my advice would be don't worry too much. However, having said that, our politicians, I don't know if you've noticed this, they don't have a lot of political courage these days.
No, they don't. Absolutely not. It's very upsetting to me. I try not to get too political, I'll be honest with you. I try and stay away from it. But, you know, I'm not happy with the way our world is going. Oh, I was raised in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and I had a wonderful life during that time period. And now it's all seems to be going away, and it's very disheartening, very upsetting to me.
Yeah, it's upsetting to a lot of people, I think. Beth Eidig, thanks for coming on and sharing the story of your great-grandfather. I appreciate you coming on this afternoon.
Thank you for calling.
I don't know where all this heads with the culture war, because that's what this is part of. But, you know, I talked about this earlier. This idiot Brent Lee keeps getting quoted. This guy, he calls himself Umar. We ripped him years ago after Ferguson because he's a nobody. And he changed his name to be politically correct. And he gets people all wound up, and then he gets quoted in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. I mean, if we wouldn't give some, it's not newsworthy that Brent Lee, who's some radical Uber driver, that's all he is. He's got no existence outside of just being a troublemaker, and the Post-Dispatch and other media outlets act like he's someone that should be given attention, and that's part of the problem with all of this that's occurring right now. And I really don't know how you fix that. I think that's just a general problem with the media getting worse and worse, and they're not going to offer. Look, I started the show this afternoon with an example of two different stories in our community that offer an opportunity to really paint a different perspective for both stories. One, the couple in the Central West End, the gun-toting Democrats that went out there, the lawyers, because, look, there is another side to that story. They broke down this little gate on private property, and there were hundreds of people storming this guy's house. The optics weren't good. Should he have pointed the guns at people? Probably not, so I'm going to ask that. But even on these protests with the St. Louis statue, there's nuance there because you had people, elderly white dude that got beat up the other day. You had people in elements of these protesters that were violent. On the other hand, in fairness, and Bill Hennessy pointed this out as one of the co-founders of the protest, the Catholic protest, there were white extremists, white supremacists, extremists mixed in that group as well, starting trouble. So it's hard to really get a handle on what really happens at these events because you got troublemakers and rabble-rousers and people that just want to get on camera as well. We'll take a break. We have audio cut of the day coming up here in just a couple of minutes.
Playback ready.
Now, the audio cut of the day.
When I was a kid, I grew up, I was not a Cubs fan, but I went to Wrigley Field. I used to see, you know, great, great players there, and some of them played in the Negro Leagues, obviously. And this is a day to honor that because it's the 100th anniversary. And some of the presidents, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Jimmy Carter, Barack Obama, sent tributes. Here's Mr. Bush and Mr. Obama.
I want to tip the hat of my favorite baseball team, the Texas Rangers, to honor 100 years of the Negro League. When I was a kid, my favorite baseball player was Willie Mays. It turned out Willie Mays played in the Negro Leagues for a brief period of time. I can just imagine what baseball would have been like had the predecessors to Willie Mays been able to play Major League Baseball.
Today, I'm tipping my hat to everybody in the Negro Leagues who left a century-long legacy of talent and spirit and dignity on our country. So here's to Satchel Paige, Josh Gibson, Cool Papa Bell, and everybody else, including three brave women who did us all proud. There were some great team names, too, like the Chicago American Giants. Couldn't think of a more fitting label for everyone who suited up. Congratulations, everybody.
Thank you, President Obama. I watched Ernie Banks when I was a kid. He played for the Kansas City Monarchs in the Negro Leagues before he played in Major League Baseball. Total Information PM is coming up next.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.